This is Audible.
Manipulation. Proven manipulation techniques to influence people with NLP, mind control, and persuasion. Written by Pete Martin and Natalie Myers. Narrated by Sam Bogart. Chapter 1. Introduction. Social psychology is a complex discipline that refers to the interplay of human emotions, perceptions, and behaviors arising from the influences inherent in culture and environment. We all have our way of looking at the world. What social psychology hopes to achieve is to explain why certain people look at the world in one way and others differently. While we're all human and subject to all the slings and arrows to which that flesh is heir, we are all unique. Without even knowing it, we are influenced by everything around us. The good, the bad, and the ugly all contribute to who we are socially, how we interact and perceive others. Sometimes these influences can skew our perceptions to an enormous degree. The influence of media, especially the new 24/7 variety, and television particularly, create an environment in which our emotions, behaviors, and perceptions are formed. Essentially, this discipline forms a bridge between sociology and psychology, with the two areas informing each other toward a more fulsome understanding of what makes people do and say the things they do when interacting with others. This discipline addresses not only individual response, but also responses seen in groups of people, and has led to the term group dynamics. This term expresses the hierarchical nature of people when forming groups of any kind. Someone is always dominant in group situations. Leaders emerge. Followers fall in line. This is the common architecture of human relationships, no matter how large or small, or whether they're casually organized or institutional. Family and social groups and workplace associations and factions, all these human groupings are subject to group dynamics and their inevitable impact on the quality of the relationships involved. This is the basis of social psychology. Most people are at least marginally aware of it, while perhaps not grasping its fundamental importance in the conduct of human affairs. This discipline forms the foundation of this book, because perception, emotion, and behavior, when keenly observed, can be influenced and directed through the subtle employment of a variety of methods that I'll describe to you, so you can use them. In essence, this book represents a popular interpretation of a discipline that renders it more accessible. The aspects of social psychology discussed in this book concern applications that can be applied more broadly toward an enhanced understanding of the people we meet every day. This forms a broader discipline than that described above. I'm going to detail for you a variety of communication tricks that can help you develop your career swiftly and effectively. There are also the techniques discussed here that can influence people toward the advancement of your goals, as well as those held in common in workplaces. By learning to understand the dynamics that are in play in all our social interactions, we can gain a better command of our function in the world and more effectively maneuver our ways through it. As you will appreciate while reading this book, people react more to nonverbal communication than they do to speeches and conversations. In fact, it's known that 75% of all communication is nonverbal, so it's only reasonable that you should pay close attention to how you come across to others in terms of your body language, mannerisms, and facial expressions. Even the way you hold yourself and the way you dress is information that is read by others. The same is true of everyone. When you're aware of these nonverbal sources of information, you can read and take advantage of them. It's important that you learn the tips provided in this book about how to read various physical signals. As explained herein, some of these signals are so subtle that an untrained eye might think little of them, yet the ability to read these signals can result in a greater mastery of social situations and business situations that can make you a leader in your social circle or workplace. In this book, you'll not just learn how to communicate effectively without speaking. You'll also learn how to influence people by transmitting appropriate and compelling body language. You'll learn to read what people are withholding as signaled to you by their body language. There is important information in every eye movement, every hand gesture, body position, stance, and facial expression. All this information can be read if you're aware and have learned to decipher the silent language employed by the human body in social discourse. Subtext is not just for words. It's also spoken by the actions of the body, the pitch of the voice, its tone and word selection. It's written in our intonations and our sartorial choices. In fact, we are walking open books which can be read by those who are well-versed in the study of nonverbal communication and its role in social interactions. In short, this book teaches you some simple methods of getting things done the way you want them done by influencing those around you with the information they freely offer via their body language, mannerisms, and other nonverbal cues. It will also teach you how to use your own body language to break down communicative barriers and establish the kind of rapport you need to build consensus with others. You'll see how efficient you can be in your work and how much more effective you can be in your interactions with others when you master these psychological and communicative techniques and are able to put them to use. After reading this book, you'll have the tools you need to make your communication highly effective and to make your social interactions more successful and fruitful. Happy reading and all the best in your efforts to sharpen and expand your communicative lexicon to encompass those things that transcend words. Chapter 1. Why do people do the things they do? Everyone reading this will be aware that psychology is concerned with the workings of the mind and how it relates to behavior. When it comes to this disciplinary amalgam called social psychology, you're not just dealing with the way your mind works. You're also incorporating social, environmental, and cultural factors, including your interactions with others, whether verbal or nonverbal. Sociology and psychology, following World War II, began to examine the intersection between these two disciplines and how they might inform each other toward a better understanding of why people do the things they do and behave the way they do in various settings. The father of social psychology is Norman Triplett. In 1898, he identified the term social facilitation to describe the tendency of people to behave differently in public than they do in private. Triplett described three major theoretical streams in identifying this tendency. Activation was the term he used to describe how arousal, response to external stimuli, relates to social interactions and informs them. Evaluation relates to the way people tailor their responses when in the presence of others who will be evaluating them, also called the audience effect. Attention refers to the way in which external stimuli distract us in the course of our social interactions and may impair our ability to engage. Triplett's theories are the first instance of the disciplines of sociology and psychology being merged in order to arrive at the function of psychology as a feature of social interactions. The three theoretical worlds described by Norman Triplett represent psychosocial lenses through which it's possible to examine the way we engage with each other and how psychological realities drive that engagement. In our social interactions, we're much more than our inherent mannerisms and idiosyncrasies. We're a world of experiences, cultural presumptions, and social constructs. To better understand why people behave the way they do, a good place to start is by examining your own reactions and responsive behaviors in confrontation of the way in which others behave. How do you react to certain situations? A man is running down the street naked. Do you laugh or do you scream? Maybe you call the police. Maybe you rip off your clothes and run along with him. Any of these reactions makes perfect sense to the person pursuing them, but which of them is going to seem more normative? That will vary greatly from culture to culture and from person to person. And while our responses to any number of incidents, events, situations, and stimuli may be somewhat culturally and socially mandated, they're also highly individual and also well within our ability to choose. We're not puppets in our play, controlled by an invisible puppet master who pulls our strings and makes us dance. We choose our responses. We choose our reactions and actions. While you're going to feel the heat in the kitchen, how you respond to it, it's a matter of choice. You either mop your brow and carry on, or run for the door, pulling at your clothes, gasping for air. Then again, it's pretty difficult to be sad at the circus. Most people love a good show. Some people, though, fear clowns. Others feel badly for the animals. So while the exception proves the rule, the truth is that our responses are all highly individual. Your responses are not predetermined. Even though it's pretty easy to predict responses in certain situations with varying successes shown above. But if that's so, then you can learn how to tailor your own behavior to present a more unruffled and confident image to others. Ultimately, you are in command of your own responses. By the same token, you are in command of your ability to engage people at a much deeper and more effective level when you're able to accurately interpret what's going on underneath their words. Remembering that triplet pointed to the fact that people behave differently in public situations than they do in private ones, we can think of the people around us as emotional onions. Just like us, they're full of layers. What the surface tells us can be deceptive until we begin peeling it back to reveal the next layer and the next after that. People have many good reasons for this tendency to conceal their true selves in public. Some of that has to do with trust. Sometimes they prefer to hide their true natures for fear of not being liked. Other times they feel it's to their advantage not to show their hand until it's time to play it. For every person on earth, there's a unique set of motivations for the modeling of two faces. This is not necessarily consciously pursued to deceive others. It's more a matter of self-preservation. And that's part of the natural human survival instinct. Chapter 2. The Masks We Wear. Emotional Responses. No one is immune to emotional responses. They are human and nobody's perfect. If you think about it seriously, living plants also react to stimuli other than water and sunshine. Haven't you heard about plants responding to the sound of certain types of music positively? The Daily Mail of April 2013 reported that scientific studies had demonstrated that plants reacted differently to heavy metal music than to soft ambient music. And if you're tempted to take the studies cited with a grain of salt, then let's look at the findings of Dorothy Retallick, who worked with other scientists to establish how playing a variety of music around plants influenced their reactions. The result of Retallick's experiments conducted in 1973 are compiled in her book, The Sound of Music and Plants. Retallick's experiments were carried out at a woman's university equipped with soundproof chambers. In each of these, she placed a plant and played a variety of different types of music in each chamber to gauge the reactions of the plants, if any. But what Retallick's experiments revealed is quite astounding. One of her researchers' most compelling discoveries is that a continuous monotone killed the plants. Unbroken 24 hours a day, the sound of the same tone killed the plants rather quickly. However, when tonal variations were played throughout the course of the day, at various times, not continuously, the plants exposed to them flourished. Like plants, human beings are not designed to operate in an emotional monotone. We are creatures of emotional diversity. We like variety, and we have different emotions. Expressed to the right stimuli, we can not only survive, but thrive. Those stimuli can come from other people, and when they're positive, we tend to thrive. Encouragement, support, and cooperative behavior feed us. Conversely, the monotonous banality of sameness can kill us. We need more than water and sunshine, just like plants. We need positive stimuli from the world around us in order to flourish. Closer to home, you may have seen a plant that goes by the name Touch Me Not. Do you think that is just a whimsical name someone came up with? Far from it. The name means just what it says. Touching this plant causes a reflexive withdrawal from its leaves in response to the stimulus. The plant reacts in the same way you do when somebody pokes a finger in your face or touches you unexpectedly. You flinch and then recoil. But when someone touches your arm to underline a point or pats you on the back, you feel quite differently. Environmental stimuli and their effect on our psychological makeup and the role that plays in our social interactions form a part of the complex nature of human interplay. There is a lot underneath the human hood, and taking it all into consideration is a lot of work. But there are many clues, both verbal and nonverbal, which can provide us with the information we need to more adeptly navigate the world around us. There's a Swahili saying which describes the role of nonverbal communication rather succinctly, Akafukusai Hakawambi Toka. This translates as, "He who doesn't want you around need not tell you to get out." You know the feeling, I'm sure. You arrive in a room full of people. You're just starting to feel comfortable when you look up and realize that an old enemy is standing nearby, glaring at you. Without saying a word, your common history rears up between you. You can practically cut it with a knife. Others may even sense the silent interchange between you. Personal history has now pierced the veil of the public world and interpolluted itself into an otherwise pleasant experience. Either you spend the evening avoiding your nemesis, or you turn tail and flee. Either way, without a word exchange, the message has been sent that the evening is going to be an uncomfortable one, whether you've chosen it or not. Is there a way that an incident like the one just described above might be managed more effectively? I certainly think so. In fact, I know very well that it can be easily diffused. Here's how the foregoing scenario might have played out differently had you been less willing to bow to the intimidation of a pair of icy eyes trained your way. You arrive in a room full of people. You're just starting to feel comfortable when you look up and realize that an old enemy is standing nearby, glaring at you. Without saying a word, your common history rears up between you. You can practically cut it with a knife. Others may even sense the silent interchange between you. Personal history has now pierced the veil of the public world and interpolluted itself into an otherwise pleasant experience. Either you spend the evening avoiding your nemesis, or you turn tail and flee. Either way, without a word exchanged, the message has been sent that the evening is going to be an uncomfortable one, whether you've chosen it or not. But you choose to push the evening's events in the direction you desire. Holding the gaze of the person glaring at you, you break into a smile and nudge your head, then turn away. The gesture may be noticed by others or not. It doesn't matter. You've responded nonverbally, indicating that you won't be intimidated, and further, that you're remaining in the room and enjoying the presence of the other people there. You have acknowledged your old enemy, without having either thrown down the fresh gauntlet or capitulated to a silent demand that you remove yourself from the situation. Chapter 3. Nonverbal Communication. The example in the previous chapter demonstrates one simple way in which nonverbal communication can help you take control of your life and also influence others. Knowing where you are and who you're with concern more than geography and facial recognition. Understanding the subtext of human interactions is a means of managing them more effectively. Understand the meaning of a glare thrown at you from across a crowded room by someone who doesn't like it is pretty simple. What's not so simple is your decision about formulating a response right then and there. In understanding what people are trying to tell you without words, you gain a confidence in your social interactions based on wisdom about people. It takes time to learn. It's in fact a life's work, but there's so much you can do right now to improve your ability to more accurately gauge what people around you are thinking, feeling, and perhaps hoping will happen when you're concerned. Here are some common ways people speak without words. Hand gestures. In some cultures, hand gestures can easily be read by others. In fact, every culture in the world uses them. In some cultures, though, hand gestures have communicative pride of place. One of these is, of course, Italy. In fact, the people of Italy are rather notorious for their tendency to talk with their hands. Some of these gestures are found in other cultures, but many are peculiar to Italy. Italian art can be seen to feature some of these, like the fascia, meaning fig, in which the four fingers are brought together with the thumb. Today, this gesture is used to express a capacity crowd in a public facility, restaurant, sports arena, coffee shop. Alternatively, the same gesture, when accompanied by a pointed back and forth motion of the upper arm, bent at the elbow, means what? Or, what in the hell? Even, what's wrong with you? But there are many universal hand gestures that can reveal what someone is feeling as you engage with them. Throwing the hands up in the air is a universal expression of exasperation. Putting a hand in front of the body with a straight arm is universally understood to mean stop. But there are other ways that hands can tell us what's going on inside the people we engage with. Gestures in which the palms are turned downward indicate authority. With the arms outstretched, this type of gesture can also indicate a sense of superiority or domination. However, when the hands are used in gestures with the palms down in the course of a conversation or business negotiation, the person gesturing is indicating an unwillingness to concede a point. When part of a firm downward motion, like chopping, the message is no. Alternatively, gestures involving open palms indicate an earnest interest in reconciling a point or a willingness to reach a concession or agreement. Palms facing up are an indication of openness. Hands clenched in fists, unless you're about to engage in a fist fight, normally indicate discomfort and a sense of insecurity about the proceedings. When the thumb is tucked inside the fist, the person making this gesture is preparing themselves to confront a perceived threat and trying to strengthen themselves in a completely unconscious way. Placing the right hand over the heart is a sign that the person you're engaging is asking for your trust and wants to be believed. It's a gesture indicating sincerity. When consciously employed, it can be a ploy to deceive people into believing that the gesture is sincere, when in fact they're lying. This gesture is situational but rooted in a desire to be believed. Pointing at others is generally considered rude. When the finger is jabbed, this gesture can be used as aggression. Generally, when people point in the course of a conversation or when delivering a speech, the import is that of authority. The gesture denotes a command of the subject as well as exhortation and a demand to be heard. Pointing can also provide emphasis, like a form of nonverbal punctuation. Hands that appear to be squeezing or rubbing each other are a sign of nervousness and self-pacification. This gesture can be seen in various forms, including lacing and unlacing the fingers, fiddling with rings or cuffs, or picking at fingernails. The indication is that the gesture is a defensive stance and feels threatened or insecure in the context of the interaction. When people place their hands on their hips, what they're doing physically is taking up more space. By physically magnifying their presence, they're establishing their authority and demanding that they be taken notice of. This is a dominant gesture, and when accompanied by planted feet and erect posture, means nothing but business. The person with their hands on their hips, particularly if their hands are in fists, is telling you that they are not in a mood for games. This is an all-business gesture, indicating that the gesture is uncompromising and not at all open to concessions or negotiations. Placing the five digits of each hand together at the fingertips is called steepling. While this gesture may easily be misread as conciliatory, what it's really transmitting is that the person making the gesture is inherently confident and authoritative. This is a person who can't be influenced unless you have an extremely good rationale for whatever it is you're attempting to pitch. The steepler is a power player. When you see this hand gesture, you have met someone of considerable intellectual heft who can see through just about anyone. Facial expressions. The human face is an expressive collection of muscles that can tell you a great deal about people. Even the most apparently inscrutable people speak to others with their faces. In some cultures, this is more the truth than others. Some cultures are even known for a particular ability to conceal the emotions by controlling the face. Most of us, though, wear our emotions and opinions right on our faces where the whole world can see them. Most of us are capable of reading facial expressions, only rather broadly. We know when someone's happy because their smile tells us. We know when someone's angry because the face contorts into an expression that is unpleasant. But there are many expressions the human face is capable of, and these can be extraordinary fleeting, remaining on the face for only from 1/15 to 1/25 of a second. That's not a lot of time to get a read. These brief expressions can reveal a lot about what we're thinking and perhaps don't want to give away with our faces. Known as micro-expressions, there are 7 to take note of. These are contempt, disgust, fear, sadness, surprise, anger, and happiness. These expressions are seen on the faces of people all over the world. They transcend cultural and linguistic boundaries. They are even seen on the faces of those blind from birth and people who have never viewed television or other film media. This means that our facial expressions are deeply encoded in our human DNA. They are something we're born knowing how to do, like breathing. Recognizing these is crucial in the project of learning to understand what people are thinking and feeling. As micro-expressions cross the face so rapidly, knowing the characteristic of each is helpful. Following are the hallmarks of each of the expressions listed. Disgust. Something stinks. This is the expression your face will form when that's the case. The nose wrinkles, and as it does, the cheeks are pulled upward and the upper lip curls. Lines form under the eyes as they're narrowed. Fear. The mouth opens and the lips are drawn back as both brows rise. As this happens, lines are formed in the forehead vertically. The whites of the eyes show above the iris. Surprise. The jaw drops as the mouth opens. The brows shoot up and lines form across the forehead horizontally. The whites of the eyes show around the full circumference of the iris. Happiness. As the corners of the mouth turn up, the cheeks rise, the corners of the eyes crease, and the lower lids become tense. Teeth may or may not be exposed. Genuine happiness is always indicated when lines form at the outer edges of the eyes. When this doesn't occur, happiness is being feigned. Anger. As the jaw pushes out, the nostrils dilate. The mouth is tense, with the corners turning down. The brows are pulled together, with vertical lines forming between them. Eyes are fixed. For this expression to be completely readable as anger, all sectors of the face must be engaged. Contempt. One side of the mouth is raised to the corner in the classical sneer. This expression may be accompanied by the rolling of the eyes. Sadness. The lower lip is pushed outward, and the corners of the mouth pulled down. The eyebrows are pulled in, then drawn up. Of all the expressions listed in this section, this is the one least likely to be feigned effectively. These are simple descriptions, but you can practice reproducing them yourself. Stand in front of the mirror, attempting to match your facial expression to an emotion, without looking at the descriptions above. Now, Do the same, following the descriptions and paying attention to any differences you note. When you're aware of the subtleties of these expressions on your own face, you'll be more likely to catch them on the faces of others. These expressions can tell you a lot about the quality of a conversation you're having and the level of honesty being shared on the part of the person you're talking to. Chapter 4. Tone and Pitch, where verbal meets nonverbal. You can glean a lot of information from tone of voice. When words are delivered in a certain tone and with a certain emphasis, they can take on different meanings. For example, someone is inviting you to an event, but you sense that the invitation is offered grudgingly. Why do you have that sensation? It's the tone. Does it seem half-hearted? A resigned or flat tone can indicate that the invitation is being recited in order to either please someone else or out of social obligation. Tone, pitch, and even the cadence, rhythm, and speed of speaking can make the difference between being heard and being talked over. You can also learn a lot about people's level of confidence from the rate of speed at which they speak. The usual conversational pace is about 140 words per minute. Faster than that, and you're perceived to be prattling. Slower than that, and you'll either have people hanging on your every word, the current American president comes to mind, or bored to death. Tone of voice completely changes the message, as we've discussed before. In the popular television show Seinfeld, when the character Newman, who is not well loved by other characters on the show, appears, the refrain is, "Hello, Newman," but the tone of voice that is delivered in is uniformly venomous. Less a greeting than a threat. Tone can convey subtext by transforming words in rather surprising ways. For women readers, this is especially important. Tone and pitch must be carefully modulated, particularly in business circles. Lowering the pitch of your voice causes your words to change in terms of value to the listener, particularly when you're talking to men. Men are known to zone out at times when women speak. It's therefore incredibly important that women modulate their voices, speaking in a manner which commands the attention of others when you desire to so command it. For women, this is a form of linguistic mirroring. Because the tone of male voices tends to be lower than that of most women, by mirroring that tonal quality, a sleight of hand is performed, in which women may mirror their male fellows and demand that they listen. The human voice is like an instrument. You are in control of it, and you decide how it's going to sound. If you're hoping to draw a listener or listeners in, drop the volume. Slow down. Watch them lean in. Vary the tonal quality of what you're saying, adding emphasis at the end of a sentence to add a question mark, which most of us do naturally, or lowering it to impart authority to your words. Pause if you need to. Consider what will come next. If you've taken the time to compose a thought and believe that it's worth listening to, have the confidence not to blurt. Take as much time delivering the thought in words as you've spent composing it. A fascinating aspect of the quality of people's voices is that they can tell us a lot about the people speaking. Everyone has a vocal quality that is habitual to some extent. Often we're unaware of it. Some people sound whiny and nasal without even knowing it. Others sound warm and effusive by nature. Then, some folks have a flat, monotonous quality to their voices. Sometimes culture and language can affect tone and pitch. Usually, though, tone and pitch imply an attitude that is unspoken but evident. Paying attention to the quality of people's voices and the sensation experienced when you hear them will train your ears to factor voice into your evaluation of those around you. Remember, they may be doing the same with you. It's important that you're aware of how you sound. You may want to practice reading out loud to get a sense of how you sound to others. You can video or record yourself and play it back. How do you sound to yourself? What mannerisms are you displaying for others to read? What is your face saying? Getting a read on yourself is a good foundation for applying your self-knowledge to your interpretation of those around you. When you are able to take an objective look at the signals you're sending, you'll be better able to read them in others. Dress and aesthetics. If you invited someone to your wedding and they showed up in flip-flops, sweatpants, and a baseball cap, as if they had just been shopping in their local grocery store or had rolled out of bed and not even showered, what would be your conclusion? You'd probably conclude that this person did not care about your wedding and was very likely not happy to be there. What other conclusion could be drawn? A person's sartorial and personal care habits are visible signs of their attitudes toward themselves and others, particularly in the workplace. A lackadaisical approach to one's appearance can indicate a lack of concern for the quality of the work, the standards of the workplace, or both. People who present themselves well look confident because they feel confident. Their hair is groomed, their clothing is attractive, clean and presentable, and their nails are clean. They know they look good. Those who tend not to care very much about the details of presentation tend not to be perceived as competent and perhaps as suffering from low self-esteem. So, it's extremely important that you send the right message to others by presenting yourself as one who deems appearance to be of some importance. That's not to say that everyone's expected to be a preening peacock, as that style of presentation can be just as distracting, if not more so, than neglect. Whether we choose to admit it or not, people tend to judge others on their appearance, and if yours isn't well curated or curated at all, with no concession to public standards, you'll not be well regarded. As I've said before, a lack of concern for personal appearance can indicate a number of realities under the surface, but sometimes looks are deceiving. People who tend not to care a great deal about their appearance can be intensely intellectual and engaged in their work. This is particularly true of computer programmers, academics, and others involved in work that involves a high level of focus. There's more to some people than meets the eye, so it's always wise to factor in variables when reaching an evaluation. As you'll know if you've read this far, knowing about people is about a lot of little things, not just one big thing. As for you, this section will have made clear the kind of message that's genuinely appealing, pride in one's appearance. That's expressed by an overall attention to grooming and appropriateness of dress. A sense of style is a bonus. If you don't have one, spend some time thinking about how those you admire present themselves and ask yourself how you might create that effect yourself. If you lack a lot of savvy in that department, remember to keep it simple, streamlined, and tidy. This will send the message that you care, are confident about yourself, but also professional. That's probably the most important factor, especially for those of you reading who hope to learn skills involved in developing influential gifts. First impressions are lasting impressions. You can be the smartest man or woman in the room, but if you look like an unmade bed, it won't matter one bit. All the factors listed are elements of communication. Everything you say, do, and wear, every expression on your face, every gesture, and every high and low in the tone and pitch of your voice tells a tale about what you intend. Knowing how to honestly evaluate yourself in all these departments is a solid way of developing your influential heft. When you know yourself and your habits and can objectively see them as elements of your own communicative style, knowing you can improve some or all of them, you'll be better equipped to influence others. By deconstructing your own style, you'll have a window into how others are communicating with you, using all these elements. Lance Burdett, a communications professional who has worked as national advisor to the New England Police Crisis Negotiation Teams, says that the importance of effective communication cannot be overstated. He is well known for his insistence that effective communication can diffuse anger and correct abusive behavior. He says that good communication skills, including evaluation of communication styles of others, are the basis for an ability to defuse potentially dangerous situations and to help reduce the toxicity of potentially explosive environments. It is, for example, very tempting to react with anger when someone speaks to you angrily. But does that get you where you want to be in terms of advancing your agenda? Nothing could be further from the truth. Having the ability to measure your response, especially in tense situations, can be crucial to a satisfactory outcome. Finesse and attention to detail are key in situations in which anger can turn to violence in a heartbeat. How effective these skills are in your everyday life is highlighted by their importance in police work, when their successful application can mean life or death. By understanding social psychology and having the requisite interpersonal skills, you have the ability to meet people where they stand and to appeal to what matters to them. Having the skill of being able to effectively read and interpret the communicative clues people send to us, both verbally and non-verbally, is the basis for social and professional success. Following is a brief summary of making your spoken communication more effective and clear. Be specific. Say what you mean. Mean what you say. Ensure that the message others receive is the one you intend, and that your gestures, expressions, body language, and tone match. There should be no perceived dissonance between these various elements of your communicative style, but when you speak with conviction and honesty, that won't be a problem. Before you can convince others or influence them, you have to buy what you're selling yourself. You're your first best or worst customer. Be sure of your message and be sure it's clear, concise, and key to the person or people you're talking to in order to find the common ground you seek. Read the signs. Good communication is a matter of persuasion, not force. Do not, for example, try to convince yourself that the listener is fully engaged with the conversation in order to flatter yourself. Sometimes people are just being polite and try not to offend you. They may be bored, offended, or tired. Pay attention to the expressions and body language of those you're talking to. Don't be a bore. It's imperative that you work on understanding the art of nonverbal communication so that you can take an accurate reading of whatever situation you're in. Proficiency in understanding people's behavior in social interactions is key to navigating them successfully. Knowing who you're talking to is of vital importance. While you may have grand ideas about the value of what you're saying, watch the listener to ensure you're not deluding yourself. Exercise critical thinking and sound judgment. Thinking critically more than anything else is about reading beneath the surface and drilling down to the core of whatever is under discussion. If someone is telling you that Proposition A is the truth and that it's been duly vetted, considered, and has buy-in, do you take this statement at face value? Or do you ensure that this is the case? Even with your own propositions, have you fully convinced yourself that you're entirely on board, or are you fudging it because you want to believe you are correct? Critical thinking is a process that precludes assumptions and a willingness to take things at face value. It demands more of you in terms of applying a judicious and objective reading of people, situations, and events. It further demands that you be willing to call yourself out at times when you haven't taken the time to obtain all the facts you need prior to making an agreement, adopting a stance, or taking an action. In essence, critical thinking is the opposite of being reactionary, acting solely on instinct, uninformed by intellectual understanding. Critical thinking and sound judgment that flows from its exercise is key to effective communication. What you discover in the process of critical thought is a 360-degree view of the truth in its fullness. This allows you to identify contingencies, worst-case scenarios, and any other possible consequences of making certain decisions, statements, or agreements. While critical thinking can't always prevent things happening that you'd rather not happen, it can work as a type of prophylactic against making errors that needn't be made, in most instances. Thinking critically implies seeing things for what they are, in all their facets. That includes the reading of people. You may look at certain people in certain ways, but are those ways critically informed? Have you asked yourself what the emotional basis for their words and actions are? Are you, in fact, being fair? In approaching interpersonal communication from a critical standpoint, you're able to apply the knowledge you gain from a critical reading of people to arrive at the best outcome for all involved without prejudice. Chapter 5. The Joy of Influence. Are you happy when people believe what you say? If you are, then you'll be happy to hear there's a way of achieving this effect systematically through the cultivation of understanding the nonverbal physical cues which form your perceptions of other people, and vice versa. Are you happy when people stop what they're doing to pay attention to what you have to say? Obviously, it's a sign they think you're worth listening to. That's why judges and house speakers use the gavel to call for silence and attention. Sometimes people are distracted, fidgety, and unwilling to collect themselves long enough to listen, particularly politicians trying to get re-elected, seated in legislative chambers. We've discussed some of the various factors involved in communication in the previous chapter. All these factors add up to whether communication is effective or not. You're not the Speaker of the House. You have no